Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, everyone. How are you all doing, Hufflings? I am Jasper William Cartwright, and as always, we have...
Leandro Natty Lewis Diaho, but everybody calls me Natty. Sorry, a girl has got a hydrate. I was hydrating
mid-drink, and I knew she was mid-drink. And I was like, she's not going to stop. She ain't stopping. She's thirsty.
I am. Hydration is important.
It is true. It is true. I am Jeremy Cobb, but some people call me Jeremizzle Cobbizzle.
Nice. Boo 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 boo. Cheesy enforced. Let's move on to the show.
Oh my god!
You will come to terms with your own weakness!
Old Prince vibe?
Focus on your task!
Yeah. Just shut your mouth! No one is interested!
You think this is just a game?
I suffer and learn!
Let's make them even more black!
We're about to get into something real big now. Amazing! Thank you for joining us again, Halflings. We hope that you are all well. We are back with another episode. We've got a question to answer at the top of our show, and then we'll be diving in today into Jeremy's DMing process, which I'm actually really excited to hear about.
Yeah.
I've played in a lot of Jeremy's games and never actually don't know how he does it. It's wizardry, as far as I'm concerned. So we have a question sent in to us from our main man, Henry Douthwaite, who me and Jeremy did a show with. So big shout out to Henry. Thanks for supporting the show. He raised quite an interesting point, which I thought, which actually Jeremy thought would be good for us to talk about. And it was about when presenting a character, and how sort of far you can push something before it potentially can feel a bit offensive. Obviously, we put on things like accents for our characters. And so how far can we push those things, and how, when we're making choices about doing a specific accent versus a different one, where is the line in it being sort of seen as stereotypical or regressive, I think is the heart of the message.
Yeah. Do you want me to read the actual question?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so he's Henry's building a new character. He's going for a hill dwarf warlock. And he looked at what a warlock could do. It appealed to his dark heart, is what he said. It appealed to my dark heart. The image on D&D Beyond was a darker-skinned dwarf, so I thought I'd build a character like that. Also, having been interested in your conversations on the podcast, I've also made her female. Obviously, I'm just building the character for the future, but what I want to ask is, if I was to turn up at a game and used her, is there a point where the character choice I've made is inappropriate? Obviously, we would perform with our characters using accents, etc. in our games. I know my own mind and who I am, but we all perceive things differently. I guess I thought I'd ask your take. For example, I see no issue with using my own accent with her, or a traditional sinister Abenazar warlock style accent, but if I were to do a deep South American accent, is that too far? I think, personally, I'm in favor of people playing characters with a different ethnic background to them. I think it can be good idea to bring diversity in the characters into your game, even if you don't necessarily have diversity at your table. I think the issue is to do it sensitively. It doesn't sound to me like Henry is being insensitive intentionally with his portrayal. It seems like a lot of his inspiration comes from the art and materials that are already available for the class and for that particular race. I think it would just be, in my mind, it's let's see if we're potentially falling into any stereotypes. And also, let's make sure we're not making a mockery of the character. So I don't, like, for instance, if you are a white person playing a character, for whatever reason, of an Indian background, I don't necessarily see a problem inherently with that. But You don't want it to turn into, yes, like, a poo.
Absolutely.
Where it feels like an insulting caricature of that character making fun of those stereotypes of those people.
I think you've nailed it there. Yeah. What I would add to that is that there's always... I think the word sensitivity sums it up perfectly because it's always about listening. Mm. I just think that it's one of those things, like, you've got to be prepared to... You know, if you're not like concerned about it, but if you're worried at all about it, the way other people might be portraying it, if you're in the moment, you're doing it, other people, whatever, feel free to open that conversation up, you know, after a session or something, and, you know, ask the DM and see how they received it, because it's a conversation. It's about, you know, learning and seeing where the boundaries are for you guys at the table. But I completely agree with Jeremy. I think that it's really important to that you have a variety of people at the table, a variety of characters at the table, so that your game feels unique and fun and exciting and different to every other game that you might have played in. So I think that would be mine, would be open up the conversation if you're in any way unsure about the nature of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess to, like, go to the point about, like, the sort of accents, I think, again, sensitivity, just to reiterate that point and drive it home, is key. I don't necessarily see a major issue with, like, a deep South accent, but I would want to know more, like, why would she have said accent? I think if everything is justified and makes sense and has been handled with a level of care and sensitivity, it would be fine. I guess, like, also when you say deep South, I'm like, are you going, like, with more of, like, an AABE sound to it? Are you talking, like, you know, African-American vernacular English? Like,
yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Sure.
That's what I would guess. Based on his description of seeing a brown-skinned dwarf.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I think it's a tightrope that you might have to walk there, because you could fall into foreign
character.
And
I think that's what Unati is saying, is about sort of doing your research, like, you know, if you're interested in that, justifying it, so that then, because I think if you justify something and you're coming from a learned place, it's really hard then for you to fall into stereotype, I think. Do you know what I mean? It's really hard for you to, because you're justifying what you're doing and justifying your decisions. Because, you know, at the end of the day, we are in a made up world with all made up people, and do you know what I mean? So the only thing I would say is, like, okay, say you're thinking about a deep South sort of accent or whatever. I mean, does it have to be deep South? Could you make something up? Maybe it has some similarities, or you use deep South as the starting point. But do you know what I mean? Like, we're creating all of this stuff as we're going. I don't see any reason why you can't push something further and really make something unique. If you're in it, like, I've always felt like if you ever get to a point where you're questioning whether something's okay or not, do you know what I mean? Like, you're probably already on the borderline of it not being okay. Because other people generally tend to be more sensitive to something that you're going to have created in your own mind.
Yeah, and also know the group you're playing with, because you may go in there being like, I've done my research, I've worked on this accent, this is not a caricature, but maybe the people that you're playing with, they might not even find it offensive. They might have some of the regressive attitudes. And before you know it, now everybody at the table is making jokes about watermelon and fried chicken. And you're like...
Which are both delicious things.
Yes, they are delicious things. Everybody likes those things, by the way. It's not just black people.
Yes.
Who doesn't like watermelon? I mean, I don't understand.
Yeah.
Kentucky Fried Chicken was started by a white guy, all right?
I mean... Okay. Sorry, we digress. Sorry, I'm really hungry. Hungry.
Hey guys, want to go get some? Can we go get some chicken after this?
I'm so hungry.
Yeah. But that's, you don't want to end up with that either, because I have not personally encountered that, but I know somebody who did. Where they were a black person playing in an all white group, and it was the DM started doing, like, some really insulting stereotypes. And most of the group was fine with it. And my friend felt really uncomfortable he tried to speak up, I think, but it was clear that no one else saw an issue with it. And it was like, oh boy.
That's gross. Please, if you ever find yourself in the situation, just try to have the conversation. If you can't have the conversation, then, like, message us or something. We'll send some people. We'll send some tieflings around to that house and sort it out.
We'll reach out. I will personally have words with them.
Yes, Ynati will use some of her gold, some of that, you know, to leverage the, you know, she's going to...
She'll have them brought before her throne.
Oh, God.
I think legitimately, though, that is potentially something that would be really interesting for the community to potentially do. Like, if you guys have had experiences like that, it'd be really fascinating to hear about those. Because I think that it's got to be... I think it's a lot more common than at least it feels like from my perspective, because I feel like I've always been a very open-minded and very sort of considered and diverse tables.
Yeah.
So I would genuinely be really fascinated to hear from the community if there are more experiences like that, because I think... And that goes for all people. You know, that doesn't just go for, black people or even people of colour, like LGBTQ+, people with disabilities, that kind of thing. I just think it's a really... Because I think it's a really interesting conversation. That like feeling comfortable at the table and something we can definitely really get into get into at a later point.
The last time I felt uncomfortable at the table, like the DM clearly hadn't, I think I've mentioned this before though, but the DM clearly hadn't considered the fact that maybe I would be uncomfortable to go to a plantation.
Yeah.
You know?
That would have been, that they should have asked you about that in advance. That would be a conversation.
I'm like, I don't really know if I want to go to a plantation and help this guy with his mission. He was clearly a weirdo racist.
No. That's a strong no. Like, strong no from me.
I don't do that.
That's a, yeah, wow. Well,
I would say, actually, funny enough, I'm glad you mentioned LGBT stuff. People, Jasper, because the most of the issues that I have had in terms of people, it's not even intentional discrimination, it's stuff like pronouns. So if there's like a non-binary character, I've played with multiple non-binary PCs and NPCs, and it, for some people, it seems extremely difficult to just remember to use they, them when referring to those in those particular characters. They'll like even you can go into it not giving any indication of a masculine or feminine gender identity in particular, but the players will read one in and then assign that based on
for sure,
yeah, which I guess is kind of tricky, but like I suppose even just having those conversations at, like in your own sort of spaces, I guess I would just correct them. Like,
yeah, that's what it's been. It's been a process of repeatedly being like, oh, no, it's they, them. They, them pronouns.
Yeah, and do that, Feel comfortable to do that. Feel free to just say, oh, no, it's they, them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Even if you have to do it like 10 times, just realize that that's okay.
Yeah.
I think one of the last things I wanted to say as well on that question, really quickly, we mentioned this before, but just try and think about how you can invert something or flip something on its head as a stereotype, because I think this is always one of the most useful tools that I find as like a DM when I'm quickly coming up with something and I'm really aware that I don't want to submit something to sound like, you know, so say I've actually got a few characters that I run at the moment who have Deep South accents or like sort of my approximation of a Deep South accent.
We all get what you're going for.
Yeah, exactly. It's in the ballpark. Always trying to think about, okay, can I make that character, can I make them really intelligent? Can I make them do something that plays against the stereotype of that particular thing that they're going up against? I think I mentioned before, like playing elves is like really ugly and rugged. You know, just finding ways to flip certain stereotypes so that it doesn't feel like, you know, so if you do go Deep South, maybe don't play further into the Deep South, any Deep South stereotypes.
Yeah.
Maybe see if you can invert something and find something a bit more nuanced to bring to the character. Yeah.
And in regards to the Abenazar stereotype, voice, I was not familiar with that because as an American, I didn't grow up seeing pantomimes, but apparently he's a very common panto villain, like in Aladdin, is that correct?
Yes.
The videos that I saw of people playing him, he sounded essentially like just an upper class Englishman in his accent.
Quite a lot of the time.
Is that correct?
I can't think of any. I think there's probably a sort of vaguely Aladdin-esque kind of accent that comes into it sometimes. Mm-hmm. But I, quite a lot of the time, like you said, I come across that sort of more like upper crust, very sort of arrogant.
Heightened RP,
type.
Heightened RP.
I wouldn't have an issue with that. Heightened RP.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I really don't care about rich old white men, so go have at it.
Just dropping the truth on you.
Sorry.
Guys. Sorry.
No, no, no.
Unless,
no.
Unless they're willing to give us money.
Sorry.
In which case, we'll care about you.
Specifically.
That's what we'll do. We'll care about you and you specifically.
Sorry.
Moving on, we would like to dive into Jeremy Cobb's DM style. We have had mine now. Yeah. We've had Unati's.
Yeah.
Now we're going full homebrew. So, ladies and gents, do what Unati is doing right now.
Taking notes.
Get your notepads and pencils, your extremely valuable pencils out.
Yes. I was about to say Palomino. Is it Palomino?
Yeah, Pimento? It's Palomino.
Yeah.
Your Palomino black wings or pearls, should you use
or
those.
Pearls.
Palomino pearls.
Ready. Where are we starting this week, Jeremy? What is the start of your process?
The start of my process is this is assuming that I'm playing with a new group or starting a new campaign. I think the bottom line thing is that I take a very player focused approach. That's kind of the logic behind every choice I make. So before we even have played a session, I go to the before we've even created a character, usually I go to the players and ask them what genre they'd like the game to be. So like high fantasy, urban fantasy, sci-fi, space opera, noir, the one that we played, I think that would have been released. Yeah, that's been released now. We did an Africa setting. So it was explicitly that was what we were doing going in. And then, based on that, I work closely with each individual player to basically build a character with a backstory that gives them a place to start. So I basically will ask them, you know, what class, what race do you want to play? And then from there, we'll start looking at, like, okay, so where are you from? Now, we have not built anything into this world yet. All we know is the genre, roughly. But like, where are you from? Who do you know? What do you want? Why are you here? What's your personality? I didn't realize this. Who do you know is actually very helpful because it gives them established relationships to play on, that you as a DM then can work with. I didn't realize this until my friend pointed it out to me last night, but I also tend to push for characters to have flaws. So if a character doesn't have one when a person first comes to me, a lot of times in my mind, the way it manifests is I'll hear the character's traits and then want to push them to their logical conclusion. So as an example, my buddy Ryan, the very first game I ever DM'd, he came in with a Minotaur barbarian named Jarl, who was min-maxed to have start with max strength and near max constitution, but a minus one, I think a minus two to intelligence, and a 10 in everything else. He was on a quest to discover this legendary sword of Skull. And so my thought process was, okay, so you've set this guy up as a pretty straightforward, he's going on a quest, chosen one type, he's going to try and conquer a bunch of land, but that's pretty basic, but he has this 7 intelligence here. What if we say part of the reason he left his clan was because no one there liked him? 'Cause he's really dumb and has no idea that how much he messes up. So like they'd be going on hunts and he would show up and be like, ha ha, and like charge in and end up chasing away unintentionally whatever they were trying to hunt. But Jarl has bought into his own legend so much that he just has no self-awareness. And so the people from the tribe went to his mom and were like, you got to get rid of this kid. And so it became part of his backstory now that like he's basically on what may actually amount to a wild goose chase, but he has no idea. His low intelligence has become a real like intrinsic part of the character that he really lacks self-awareness and does not realize the impact that his actions have on those around him a lot of times and how he comes across. That's kind of where we started. That's how we started with that particular character. And I did the same thing actually with Jasper and Unati when we were building characters. Except you guys both came with like very well-developed character personalities and everything. So there wasn't a whole lot that I needed to provide in that case.
Yeah, I think you definitely pushed us to think about flaws and things like that, like when you were just sort of briefly what you described. And I think you definitely pushed me, I think, to follow, like you said, to follow it to the natural conclusion.
Yeah.
Of like, okay, so this guy, you know, you very much said like, oh, he's never left the island. Like, what effect does that have on him? And that played into a lot of how I did, like, sort of made the character in the first place, where I might not have considered that. So it was really nice, actually.
Yeah, no, it was a very enjoyable process. I especially enjoyed the detail that you took about looking at all of the facts about the Dasi and how you could incorporate all of those into the character.
Yes, that's true. Because you guys had existing animals, I looked at what the actual animals were like and what their abilities were as animals, and tried to incorporate that. So we kind of homebrewed elements into those characters because of what animal they were based on.
Which was pretty fun.
Essentially, I actually recently, when I started running slightly higher level campaigns that aren't starting at level one, I will let higher level characters start with a single magic item, so they can choose. They can even make one up. But it gives everybody, like, a greater customization.
That's cool.
And I don't do this all the time, but I also like to give people the opportunity to choose a theme song for their characters, so that, like, when everybody introduces their characters at the beginning, I'll play the theme song underneath it. So the theme song for Jahl, for instance, was War Pigs by Black Sabbath. So,
yeah,
like,
you did
hear
that with us.
Yeah, I did that with you guys. War Pigs, so it would be, like, this intense, like, guitar riff, and then Born in the mountains on the Minotaur tribe, Jahl. Like, immediately you know who that guy is. You know who this guy is.
Yeah.
And every single part of him makes sense from then on. It's like, I get it. From there, I will go away and start building a setting and a story based on what I've established with the characters. And so that's where working on where those people come from is very, very useful. Because now you have, just from working with your players, potentially one or more locations that you've already partially designed. And you have multiple NPCs now that you've partially, at least, established. So you maybe have an idea of what their personality is and what their relationship to the PC is. And so, and my big thing is that I always make sure that the setting choices fit with whatever I've previously established with the players and their characters, and especially making sure that every single character has a reason to care and a reason to be there that feels true to who they are, because the goal is to maximize player investment. So there should these characters should not be told to do anything that they're not interested in doing, that they have no reason to care about. For the session that I ran with you guys, Nandi loves yams. Okay, yam festival. You have every reason to care about what's happening in the city. Just wants to explore and meet new people and fight things. So let's have a convention where people from all over are there. People, the kinds of things you never would have seen before. And on top of that, there's a huge threat now. And it's yams. So not only does Nandi have every reason to care, but now Ra Bumpurum cares that he gets to defend people from these monstrous yam creatures.
Absolutely.
So I don't have to work then to get them to do kind of what I want them to do, because they already want to do it.
That's really interesting.
I'm already annoyed that the yams are not delicious. I'm genuinely pissed off.
She's still not over the awful yams. But that's a really interesting thing, because I think that as a DM, quite often. It kind of goes back to like the whole thing of like, realize that your players are having more fun, but it's quite often I think you can fall into the trap of like, oh, how can I get them like reinvested? Or, you know, like there's always that worry, I think, like, especially like after they complete like a main quest or something, like, how do I get them reinvested in the story? How do I get them to like move on to the next thing? And I think that much like Jeremy was saying there, is that if you maximize player investment, that'll really help.
I was going to say that is something I'm going to address later in terms of moving from one quest to another, because you've introduced stuff, and the players have started to interact with the world, now all you have to do is look at what they already care about and what they already want to do, and then introduce something that ties in with that. But that's going to come in just a little bit.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to talk about. It's just that I think there's an element of trust there that I think I've fallen into the trap a few times of being a DM who goes, oh, like, are they... and they invested, are they enjoying this? Or maybe I should throw something in there to keep them. But actually, you don't worry. Like, they're in. They're interested. They're involved. They're invested. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, nine times out of ten, they will come to a session and have an idea about what they want to do next. You don't need to force it.
Yeah.
And quite often, what they will kind of present to you will be far more interesting than the idea that you've panickedly scrambled together.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway, carry on.
Another thing that I'll do is I'll let players name and or help design locations that their characters are from, so that they have a more of an emotional attachment to those locations. I didn't get to do it as much with you guys, in part because Nandi, you are, we went over the workings of your tribe, so we know that if we were to ever meet them, what their social structure is and how it all functions.
Yeah.
But there's a character in one of my games who is from the Feywild, and so I basically had, I sat down with her and she told me what she wanted the Feywild to look like. Now, obviously, she didn't dictate every single part of what that area, what that plane is, but that part of it that her character is actually from, she now has a very strong emotional attachment to.
Yes.
And when that eventually shows up, it'll be like, aha, there it is. Oh, there's the, and it's like she's been here before. It's like her character is there. It's like, oh, there it is. And I will say this, I use Evernote, the program Evernote, to write all this down. It allows you to create a notebook that you can title and then create individual notes inside of that notebook. So I'll create a notebook for the campaign as a whole, and then I will create a different note for each session, plus additional notes, one for character backstories, one for setting info, one for unused ideas that I've come up with that I'd like to just stick in there at some point. I use D&D Beyond to help players create the characters. For anybody who doesn't know, it's a website that it has. Basically, through that website, you can get access to all of the Wizards of the Coast, like official D&D 5e material, and you can then use it for free, actually, as a character creator. You will have to pay for some of the specific stuff from the books, potentially, but the player handbook stuff is all free, and you can just build a character. Very intuitive, and it makes the character creating process much, much easier than just approaching it with pencil and paper, I find.
Yeah. Yeah,
and plus
too.
Also during these times, if you're Zooming your DM or whatever via your computer, you can also get an app now, which is quite handy, which has like all of the stats and stuff on it, which is really useful.
And they haven't they just introduced a dice roller on there.
Yeah, which is great.
Yeah. But support your local dice makers because we love dice.
So many dice.
And in terms of specific world building stuff, I try to build locations that sound cool to me, then that also makes sense with what we've already established. And I used to do this, I don't do it anymore, but I used to find pictures of every location and monster that I would physically show to the players, so they'd have a clear idea of what I was talking about. I think you might remember that, Jasper. I haven't been doing it because I'm not physically in the same space with the characters anymore, or with the players anymore, but I also used to find music for every setting, and even specific events or characters. I'm a big fan of villain music. You probably would remember this, Jasper, that when I used Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child for Dreybold.
Yeah, which was amazing.
Yeah, it works so well.
I remember that session because half of our party we were almost like in two parts because there's so many people that were kind of getting involved, and I remember sitting just like listening to this one, like I wasn't even a part of that session, and you started playing like the Sometimes I Feel Like was coming down the corridor. I remember we were all sat around a table, and I remember like these were complete like D&D noobs, like none of us had played before, and just the look on people's faces of like, this cannot be good. Like, there was such fear. Like, this is bad.
Yeah. And my main party, the same thing. And I actually, recently, they fought, like, a resurrected sort of undead dream version of him. And they were in this haunted house setting. And the cellar door opened. And they just heard that music playing. And the look on the player's faces of like, oh, no. Because they all knew it's been a year since he showed up. Like, it's been a year since they heard that song, and it was an immediate, like, visceral reaction for everyone, just like, oh, no. So that can be extremely useful. I also like to use tabletopaudio.com, because they have a lot of just, like, ambient ambient sounds for various settings. So you can be like in a tavern or in a forest or in a cave, different things like that. And I also have a specific battle playlist that I like to play of just mostly rock songs that have a lot of energy and oomph to them.
Yeah, yeah, I like your choice of music is so much better than mine. I'm just I'm still getting used to like juggling like 4 million things via Zoom. I feel like my but yeah, you've got some strong battle music. It's like there's nothing quite like when some like AC/DC or like Led Zeppelin kicks in when you're like midway through like kicking some ass. Like it's really fun.
Yeah, or like Run to the Hills comes on. Like it's like a triumphant moment. It gets epic. I also usually, in terms of world building, will only build what is necessary to run the story that we're currently trying to tell. So in terms of like the setting that that we played on the show, I only know the stuff that we established. I don't really know much about any other spot because I don't need to, because we're not going there. Like if we go there later, then yeah, okay, yeah, we build it. But other than that, it's unnecessary. I don't like to give myself extra work. But when writing, the next thing is NPCs. NPCs can be incredibly important. I did not, like, until I really started to think about it and observe, like, how different games functioned, NPCs can, in some cases, almost make or break a campaign.
Yeah, I agree.
When writing NPCs, I try to give each of them a specific personality, a tiny bit of history, and a goal. Just so they feel like real people. So it's not just, if it's not just some tavern merchant, or not tavern merchant, but just not just some like random merchant. It's a merchant who secretly wishes, to dance. That is their dream, but they were pushed into this by their, father who wanted them to carry on the family business. And that's all you need. And as soon as that, and now you have like a little element of like, you could just have a little bit where like in between helping the players, they glance over and the merchant is just dancing to themselves. And it makes them immediately way more interesting because now it feels like a person. And I want the players to feel like these people would have just still been living their lives if the players hadn't shown up. And I'll often have them do stuff off screen in between appearances so that they've changed since the characters last saw them. I had one time, it was like the Earl of a region show up, and he was clearly unfit for his job. He was very in over his head. Very, very nice, but he was nervous, terrified, weak-willed, all these things. But he got essentially kidnapped by this sort of Rambo-type character. The Rambo-type character was trying to protect him. And took him away. And the next time he showed up, he was like, he'd gone full Rambo. And like he was a halfling, and the Rambo character was like a medium sized character. So he had the Earl and a little baby Bjorn. And the Earl was like holding like a sickle and had like war paint and all this stuff. And like was wearing all black, and they'd gone full on like special ops.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
And it also gives the players an opportunity to build a relationship with those people and really have something to hook themselves into the world. A lot of the most emotionally impactful moments in the campaigns that I've run have been when bad things have happened to NPCs. Pretty much all of the tiers, in fact, have happened. We've had multiple character deaths, like player character deaths, and the only time we've had tiers is for NPCs. And it'll be like various NPC death scenes. Those can hit hard, man.
Yeah. Yeah, they really can. Yeah. Oh, the first one, we had one in the campaign that I run with you, Jeremy, that was wow. Like the reaction of you guys was incredible. Like like our fun loving bard who was just sort of like wide-eyed wonder turned into like this like, you know, murder monkey was just going around like, ah, you know, it was amazing.
He was a man on a mission, dude.
It was incredible.
I guess in terms of session to session planning, I used to plan for as many eventualities as possible. So I would think of like, well, they could do this, or they could do this, or they could do this, or they could do this. So here's a separate plan for every single one of those things. That got to the point where I at one point planned, I think, 6 possible sessions for a single session.
Wow.
And it was a document that was over 10,000 words long.
Whoa.
And at that point, I was like, that broke me. Like, I was like, this is a problem. I literally called a friend and was like, I need to figure out how to do this differently.
You can't do this.
So since then, I have, I have ramped down a lot to just trying to have. Really, I'll send. I have a video one time of me the document that I'll send to you. Just how long it was.
And I feel like it's very easy to get there.
Yeah,
it's very easy to get there.
Yeah, it was based in fear. But since then, I've ramped down to just trying to have the necessary info. So where are we? Like the name of the location, what it looks like, what it feels like to be there, kind of the culture, any relevant information about like the layout of the city. So for instance, when you guys went to the city, Manyikeni, I think is the name. I told you what the walls looked like. I told you it was a huge city. And then I told you about the relevant, the relevant parts. And if you guys had chosen to go somewhere else, then yeah, we'll figure, like, I'll improvise some stuff because I now have a basis for what this place is like. But that, playing it, it didn't feel like you guys were like, ah, yes, this cardboard city we've walked into. It was like, oh, okay, yeah, big bustling place. Here we are.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing, like, trust your players are filling in this world and making it so colourful and, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, Manyikeni, for me, I have a really clear image in my head of what that looks like, and you didn't go into, like, half an hour's worth of description, do you know what I mean? It's not always that necessary,
I guess. The players will fill it in for you. I'll fill in also social structure of the place, if it would be relevant. I'll figure out who is here. I will often only create like a few key NPCs, and then I'll have a list of names and a list of jobs. And if a player wants to go to a certain spot, I look at the list of names. That's the person's name. Okay, this is what they do. And I'll just improvise essentially in response to what the players want to do. I do also look at what do the people here want? Like, what is their goal? What's the kind of the culture of the place here? And what threats are there? So I'll have like the stat blocks for any potential villains. And I, similar to Unati, I pre-roll initiatives for all NPCs.
This HeadGum podcast is brought to you by Aura Frames.
That is right.
From grandmothers to new mothers, aunts, even the friends of your life, every mom loves an Aura Frame.
Holy shit, even aunts?
Yes, especially aunts.
Oh, well.
Because it was named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things. I mean, these Aura Frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages.
I believe it.
You have an Aura Frame, don't you?
Yes, I actually more than believe it. I know it. I've got one for my mom, my mother-in-law, my grandmother-in-law.
And dare I say, your aunt?
And dare you say, my aunt and my aunt-in-law. Everyone's got one. Everyone loves them.
I mean, Mother's Day is right around the corner, and there's no better gift than a digital photo frame. You give them the frame. It's got preloaded pictures in there. And you know what? You can update it with an app. So every time you take a new picture of a sweet little person or place or thing in your life, it gets automatically sent to that frame.
Exactly.
And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. Holy smokes.
Excellent deal.
Yeah, that's AuraFrames.com. You use the code HEADGUM at checkout to save.
HEADGUM. Nice.
Yes. HeadGum. It's easy to set up. It's loved by everybody, including Oprah, including your aunt.
Mm-hmm.
So do check them out. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code HeadGum at checkout to save.
Damn right.
And terms and conditions apply, of course.
Of course.
Thanks again to Aura.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective, unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Yeah, that's a great one. I always think that the NPC things are so funny when you're like, you'll have NPCs that you really flesh out, have got goals and things like this, and the PCs walk up to that NPC and be like, hi, how are you? What information can you give us? Okay, cool, thanks, bye. And then you'll improvise a little goblin called Bibble who owns a sweet shop, and they'll be like, hey, do you want to join our party?
Yeah.
And they roll a ridiculously high like persuasion check, and suddenly they've got this goblin called Bibble that I know nothing about.
Yeah.
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 It's it's always the way.
Exactly. It's never who you want it to be.
Yeah. I actually did have a question for you, Jeremy, if I could. Because for those who don't know, like, obviously I've played with you a lot and I know that you know, you're very learned on the rules and the kind of, the sort of mechanics of it. So mm-hmm. I was wondering, like, how do you approach improvising things in the moment? Because obviously you said then that you'll try to do a little bit less. So say we did go to a different part of Manya Kenny. Mm-hmm. I tend to find that it's like, if I create enough of a framework, then I feel comfortable to improvise. But I wonder whether yours is a slightly more kind of rule-based improvisation or what's the mental process for you when improvising?
Honestly, the rules only come into combat for the most part, or specific skill checks.
Or like spells.
Yeah, or spells. Like anything that there is a rule written for. Then sure, yeah, we can incorporate the rules. But in terms of like, you just want to talk to this person? Okay, yeah, I will play this person as best I can and we will have a conversation. I won't know how the conversation's going to turn out going into it, but it's just like when, I've forgotten the elephant's name, but the elephant guy, when you guys walked up to the elephant, I knew that he was like the foreman of these guys who were helping to unload stuff at the docks. And I knew that he just wanted to do his job right and that he was very nervous about this boat. But a lot of it was, like, in terms of how he would receive you guys, it was like, yeah, I guess we'll see. And
Yeah.
So that was entirely improvised.
I like Uncle.
He's a cool dude.
And then just sort of like more to that, like, then in terms of like, if anything, anything big happens, like what's your, cause like that happens, you know, sometimes we're always going to have blind spots as a DMs. And like, I don't know if someone can legitimately teleport somewhere or finds a way to commune with a god or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, I was just wondering, like, what's your process of dealing with moments like that? Because that can be a real, like, hit panic button moment.
Yeah, you just, at that point, you just gotta buckle in. Buckle in. Jesus, take the wheel. Let's just go.
Take it all the way.
Just floor it and see what happens. There was actually, that leads into what I was gonna say, because that stuff can actually be incredibly helpful. There's two quick examples that I'll write name. One was a game that you played in. Jasper. It was when you guys were trying to free those tieflings who had been enslaved by that town. And you guys had dressed... There's a changeling character who basically had been posing as an angel. This character, she transformed to look like an angel. And they had given her, like, a flaming sword. And, like, she was rising into the air on a magical flying ladle. And was freaking out the inhabitants of these people who were all, like, aligned with... They all were big fans of, like, devils. But little did the group know that there was a very powerful warlock who was the mayor of this town, and he comes out, sees what appears to be an angel flying up into the sky above his city, and proceeds to banish her. He casts banishment and banished her to, like, a celestial plane. She then met some actual angels, talked them into joining her, rolled really high persuasion, and got five. So I immediately had to look up an angel stat block and got five angels to show up. And they brought her back. I think it was either his concentration got broken. Yeah, it was his concentration got broken. She reappeared. The angels crossed over after her. She sent them after the guy. And I think the final tally was something like 267 points of damage. These angels... Their swords do insane amounts of... And they all flew over. It was the one guy. And this was going to be a tough fight. But not anymore. But it ended up being one of the most memorable things.
We were level 3?
No. You guys are level 6.
We were level six. Okay, yeah.
But even so,
like, you're still probably doing a maximum of like 30 damage total in a round.
Like, what an unnecessary show of force! Just like, bang.
We were sat at the table, just being like, I think he's so dead. It's hard to know whether he actually existed in the first place.
Yeah, he was retroactively erased from some of the
really
time.
Dead.
He's been expunged.
And then the angels ended up giving that character like a small boon. After that.
Yes.
So that was one thing. It ended up becoming a really memorable moment. Or another thing, and this leads into This ties into what you were mentioning earlier, Jasper, about leading into separate camp, next story arc. So that Rambo character, the first time he appeared, he was hunting a tiefling, but he was referring to the tiefling as a demon, and we hadn't seen the tiefling yet, but he essentially was interfering with something the players were doing because he wanted information. And he is like, he's a blood hunter, so he's like full on like, no, it is my way or the highway. And he got into a fight with these guys, and Jahl, the Minotaur, had never seen a blood hunter before. So when he sees him using his blood hunter powers, Jahl's like, I want that power. And I never planned for this, but he grapples him. This character, the NPC's name is Urquhart Tate, the Rambo guy. Jahl grapples Urquhart Tate and proceeds to bargain with him and offers to join the blood hunters in exchange for receiving blood hunter powers. And he's like, look, you can get the information that you need. All we need is for you to wait a little bit, but I will join with you. And I'm like, oh! And one of the other characters hates blood hunters. It's like the number one thing she despises. The other character is like, I think this guy is bad. So the other two players are screaming at Jahl, like, what are you doing? And like yelling, and it became the biggest thing. And now after, because of that, when they eventually fought Urquhart Tate again and seemingly had killed him, Jahl then resurrected him without anyone else noticing, rolled a natural 20. He wasn't fully dead, but he gave him a potion of healing and basically told him, remember who helped you. And then they moved on. Urquhart Tate then escaped. And then the next arc, I'm like, okay, well, we got to bring the Bloodhunters back because it led into the next thing. So then it was like, okay, let's have an interesting dynamic be that they have to team up with the Bloodhunters because we've already established that we don't like them. What if they in order to stop a larger foe, they have to team up? And so it's like, who these Bloodhunters serve? Lucine, is the goddess of the moon. I do draw from like Forgotten Realms stuff as I see fit, essentially. So I'll just rip something off and be like, okay, so she's the goddess of good lycanthropes. This guy is a blood hunter, Order of the Lycan blood hunter. So he could turn into like a lycanthrope character. Let's have a bunch of evil lycanthropes show up. And then we start looking at evil lycanthrope gods. Okay, Malar, evil lycanthropes. I see something about halflings, the ghostwise halflings. And it led into all this other stuff. And they were in a halfling kingdom. And that's how it then led into the next story. It was stuff that it was decisions the players had made that influenced the next part of the story, which I find is much more effective for keeping people invested and also just making it, making a story that makes sense, than just trying to spin something out of whole cloth. The next, go ahead.
No. I did actually have a quick question because it was a compliment, really. Was like, whenever I've played in your games, every session's always felt really well balanced. It's something that I still feel like I struggle with as a DM. Is sometimes like, okay, that session was like a little all over the place or a little, you know. And I think partly it's because I feel like I let my players get away with too much. But, but I was just sort of interested, like how, like. Is there like something that you sort of try to drop in, like, you know, whether it's like, okay, we haven't had combat in a few sessions, so I'll aim for a combat in this session, or, you know, is that like something that you're aiming for as like an interesting hook, or do you know what I mean?
I try to include. I don't necessarily have a combat in every single session. I think I'm absolutely fine with just having an exploration RP session. But what I like to have is, once I've established who the bad guys are, they're doing stuff off screen. So it's possible that the players will run into them. So, for instance, in the Noir game that I run, there's shadowy organized crime organizations who are constantly doing stuff. And there will be evidence of their activities, sometimes that directly affect the players. There was a character recently, he's on the baseball he's playing an away game, and the entire team was given champagne, and he drank the champagne only to realize that it had been poisoned in some, and he's not sure who did it, why they did it. But it immediately adds like a sense of intrigue. So the rest of that session was spent was him reconnecting with his roots, because he's from this city, and meeting old friends and allies and seeing how things had changed since he'd been gone. But I try to have plot relevant information available, And very, like, hopefully the players will be seeking it out because, you know, they'll be motivated to try and learn more about what's going on at that point. So mm-hmm. whether it's they go mm-hmm. to a library and they read about it, or there's an NPC there who knows what's going on, or has some artifact that is in some way related and hints at something else that mm-hmm. will eventually tie together down the line. Try to have that in there, but in the middle of, like, it's just in the setting. And essentially, yeah. I think I've talked about it before, but there is such, there you can essentially just say, okay, even if they don't go there, this person's going to show up here instead. It's essentially yes. Like I've said, absolutely. The Buddha's hand thing from Journey to the West. You thought you flew out of Buddha's hand, but in reality, you were inside it the whole time. It's the Bandersnatch illusion of choice.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the, to that end, the, what was I going to say? It's gone out of my head. You know, if you have any questions,
I've just been studiously taking notes. So I guess
the last thing I was going to talk about was combat. In yes, regards,
because you run some very good combat,
thank you.
Which I'm gutted that the audience didn't get to see in the last session.
Maybe
someday soon.
Hopefully. So in regards to combat, if it's the first time these people have ever played, then it'll be a pretty straightforward combat usually. But I still like to create combats with interesting stakes and settings. Whether that means introducing interesting terrain. There was one session where you didn't play in it, Jasper, but these people were fighting on a ship and there were like winged kobolds up attacking the rigging of the ship. But at the same time, there were other kobolds on the deck fighting crew members. So there were a lot of different aspects to the fight that you could get involved with. I like to incorporate interesting tactics. So with the group that Jaw plays in, there was a session where they encountered a bunch of knights. They had basically been framed for having, they were framed for having kidnapped the Earl. Because the bad people were like, oh no, we've been discovered. Right. Well, we're in power currently, so our only way to hide this is to make it look like they're the bad ones. So they framed them for having done it. And these knights showed up to arrest them. And there were knights, archers, and then a mage who had previously cast invisibility. And when it became clear, like, on himself. So when it became clear that the party was going to try and fight, that mage pops up out of nowhere and casts Cone of Cold. Mm. And straight up killed multiple animal companions and, like, seriously injured the party. And now we're in a seriously, like, now you have a mage who's blasting from the back, who's got fireball, who's hiding behind the front lines. You have a bunch of knights, all of whom are holding, like, glaives and pole arms, standing two in a group. And behind each pair of knights, you have an archer. So the archer is just sniping. Wow. So basically, you have to then tactically fight. So, like, the druid, who is pretty squishy, runs into a house. And then just pokes her head out and starts casting lightning, call lightning on people from inside there. So she's basically impervious to harm now. The rogue turns invisible, runs around behind enemy lines. It's just going after the mage. And then the the ranger and the barbarian just charge into the front lines. But it became like they're now having to use tactics. Another example, they fought. It was several characters, three sisters, the Moira sisters, and they were all very powerful lycanthropes. And one was a were-leopard who was a rogue, and they were fighting in a forest. And the were-leopard hid in the bushes, had a really high stealth stealth modifier, and she would essentially jump out and just try and like support snipe people, slashing them up over their claws. They had a were-boar who just charged in as a barbarian and like hit me, and she was bear totem barbarian, so all the damage is getting halved, including the magic. And then there was a were-gibbon wizard, and gibbons are incredibly agile, so the gibbon immediately goes into a tree and is sniping from above. And that was one of the toughest fights we've ever had.
Brilliant.
And then there's fights such as they fought were spiders, so there's webs everywhere, so that they can either have halved movement, or they can roll a check to try, like a dexterity check, to try and make their way through, or they get grappled by the webs, and the spiders can, of course, climb and everything. And they can also attack the webbing and destroy it if they want to clear areas. And then most recently, they fought in like a shifting dream maze, like a living maze, and at the top of each round, the maze would shift again, And depending on what everybody rolled on a D6, they'd end up in a different part of the maze with potentially different enemies.
Amazing. Yeah.
And that ended up not awesome. Only... That ended up actually saving Jahl because there was a revenant there that was dead set on killing him. And she took him down multiple times to zero and was going to kill him. She would have killed him had she been in the same part of the maze as him. But she kept getting shifted away at the top of each round. So stuff like that can keep things very engaging and interesting.
That's really cool.
That's really cool.
And in terms of balancing fights, I find PCs... This is something I learned from watching... a lot of the DM advice videos that Brennan Lee Mulligan does from Dimension 20, he talks about how PCs are a lot stronger than you think. And they can handle a lot. And so he said that he does this, and that, so I do it too. If I want a fight to be tough, I will just throw in crazy, some really strong high-level bad guys, and a lot of them. The PCs will figure out a way to win. And for that, I'll have like units of bad guys on a single initiative. So I'll just roll multiple. I use a dice roller app for this. So I'll just like press D20 three times real quick for their attacks to know whether they hit, stuff like that. And I'll plan their tactics ahead of time and know what abilities they have and all that stuff. So that's pretty much.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, I did that for the first time recently. It was like planning tactics ahead of time, and it really helped. It was the hag fight that you had, Jeremy, recently. I very much like they came in with the tactic that they were going to try and curse as many targets as possible, because curse means you have disadvantage on wisdom saves, and then all of their spells are wisdom saves.
Yeah.
So that was like basically that was what they were going to go ahead and do. And that really, really helped, I think, the way that fight
played out. Yeah, I mean, that's why Gundam died.
Yeah, planning tactics.
Because of curse.
Of time is...
That's what killed him. He gets the disadvantage on all those wisdom saving throws. Then he eventually got death glared.
And that's what did it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. It was grim. I actually remembered what I was... I was going to say earlier, which is about the... I really liked what you said about having the bad guys kind of off on the side doing stuff. Mm. It's something that I've tried to do with mine. And I think what's really cool about it is it gives players a sense of, like, time as well. And that, like, if they spend... you know, four sessions in a row just like shopping, or you know, that like some really bad stuff might be happening at the same time, you know, that like if they've got like a core mission that maybe they want to get on with it, because, and that's not to say that you have to be really strict and stop players from having the fun, but like I think it's a really nice way of like really introducing a sense of like stakes and
urgency
of that living world. If your bad guys, like your bad guys aren't going to waste time shopping, do you know what I mean? They're going, they're out there right now, they're hunting people down, they're doing their thing, they're getting the items, they're, you know, they're doing their work. Yeah, exactly. And I think there's nothing kind of nicer than like players coming to a point being like, yes, we have succeeded in the mission, and then be like, oh, the item's gone. Like, yeah, because you took like 3 weeks to get here.
Yeah.
Like, and they already knew about it.
Yeah.
Like, of course they were gonna beat you. You know, what did you expect?
Yeah.
So like stuff like that, I just think is really really enriches the play.
Yeah, and I would say as much as you, in terms of combat and stuff and running bad guys, as much as you want to make it challenging for your players to win, it can be extremely rewarding when they just dominate. So every once in a while, it's good to, especially if if it's due to their own ingenuity. If it's just them being smart, it's like, I mean, go for it. Like, that is just cool.
Yeah,
you've got to reward that.
Yeah.
You've got, like, when like, because, I mean, I've had whole sessions where, like, the bad guys have just been negated straight out. You know, like, whatever they had, whatever their thing was, the player was like, if I cast this, and you instantly as a DM.
Oh my gosh, that Moira sister fight. To this day,
how did I not
the
think
druid.
Of that?
Okay, so the wizard has counterspell. The wizard, the weregibbon has counterspell. I have counterspell. So if this druid tries to cast like any healing spells or whatever, then I can counterspell him. But the druid keeps intentionally running out of range because she knows she's squishy, so she keeps getting out, and I don't think she even realized that she was out of counterspell range, but she would, like, her tactics just kept stopping me, and I'm just like, oh! And there was nothing, it was really well played on her part. She absolutely was the MVP of that fight. At one point, literally, the only people still standing were her and one allied NPC, and several of their fellow characters have been captured, and the wizard was flying away with all of them piled up on Bigby's hand and was literally on the verge of escaping until like the druid did some stuff to interfere. But it was just like, oh my gosh. But you got, I mean, yeah, you got to take the L's, because the goal is for your players to have fun. I mean, if they're having fun, then I'm having fun, as far as I'm concerned. So, yeah,
absolutely. And there's nothing, I think there's nothing better than as like a DM feeling like getting that bit, that kind of like moment where you go like, oh, I'm kind of proud of you for that. Like, that was kind of clutch, you know, like that was what you just did. That was real cool. That was really, really cool. And I have to reward that.
I get
really proud of my players, especially some of the newer ones where I'm like, what? That was, I would never.
Yeah. Okay. Just stuff you never would have expected. The angel thing. Yeah. The angel thing. Absolutely. I love that. That was such a good idea.
Yeah, the angel thing. Yeah, no, such a good idea. Not a chance.
That stat block. When she, five angels. Five angels.
And I never, and I thought she's been neutralized. And instead it's like, no, you have been neutralized. I have been neutralized.
Yeah, you have been neutralized.
At that point I'm just like, just slow clap. Because that's just good job on her part. Good thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, because also equally, then you have to, because then you get to weigh it when players make really stupid decisions, which is really fun. Like, for instance, when Dennis, Jeremy's character, when I said, like, they were like, oh, can I cast, like, detect magic on this box? And they were like, I was like, yeah, there's really strong, like, necrotic energy coming out of this thing. And Dennis just went, I'll open it. So the rest of the party cast Leoman's tiny hut and hid inside it. Dennis went outside of the hut to open the chest, at which point there was basically it was like the same thing that the intellect devourer uses.
Was it feeble mind?
That kind of bursts out of this feeble mind. That's it. Yeah, bursts out of the chest. It was like a trapped spell in there. Bursts out of the chest. Dennis gets reduced to like a vegetable, and then the party went, well, yeah, we probably should have seen that coming. And it was just like, you guys are so like, you like sometimes you just obliterate foes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But then, on occasion,
take a big L.
That was a fun DM win, you know, where I was just like, ha, that was stupid. I even told you this is a bad idea. Like, I literally told you necrotic energy is flowing out.
Dennis felt bad because he thought he was responsible for the death of that NPC that we mentioned earlier. And so as part of it, he's like, look, if anybody should be put in danger, it should be me. And goes,
it should be me.
He was in danger. He was very
marvelous.
I'm still just shook by these angels. I'm literally looking at the stat block now, and I'm like, five.
267.
I'm gonna look
damage
up the exact number, because it was an incredible amount. I'll look it up later, but it was so much. It was Oh man.
I can't.
Marvelous. Well, this has been Jeremy's DM playstyle. I hope you've enjoyed listening to it. That's all of our playstyles are out there now.
Yeah.
So let us know your thoughts, if you use any little tips and tricks that we give you, or if you think, hey, this is all garbage and I'm going to do it my own way. That's totally fine. But we hope you've enjoyed this episode of Three Black Halflings. Don't forget to follow us and like us and share us with your fellow adventurers, because that really, really helps. Oh, there it is. And we will see you next week with another episode of Three Black Halflings. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Bye.